the target buyer group of the industry. Accordingly, the industry geared its attention and efforts to produce purer insulin in response to doctors' quest for better medication. The issue was that innovations in purification technology had improved dramatically by the early 1980s. As long as the purity of insulin was the major parameter upon which companies competed, little progress could be made further in that direction. Novo itself had already created the first human monocomponent insulin that was a chemically exact copy of human insulin. Competitive convergence among the major players was rapidly occurring. Novo Nordisk, however, saw that it could break away from the competition and create a blue ocean by shifting the industry's long-standing focus on doctors to the users, patients themselves. In focusing on patients, Novo Nordisk found that insulin, which was supplied to diabetes patients in vials, presented significant challenges in administering. Vials left the patient with the complex and unpleasant task of handling syringes, needles, and insulin, and of administering doses according to his or her needs. Needles and syringes also evoked unpleasant feelings of social stigmatism for patients. And patients did not want to fiddle with syringes and needles outside their homes, a frequent occurrence because many patients must inject insulin several times a day. This led Novo Nordisk to the blue ocean opportunity of NovoPen, launched in 1985. NovoPen, the first user-friendly insulin delivery solution, was designed to remove the hassle and embarrassment of administering insulin. The NovoPen resembled a fountain pen. It contained an insulin cartridge that allowed the patient to easily carry, in one self-contained unit, roughly a week's worth of insulin. The pen had an integrated click mechanism, making it possible for even blind patients to control the dosing and administer insulin. Patients could take the pen with them and inject insulin with ease and convenience without the embarrassing complexity of syringes and needles. To dominate the blue ocean it had unlocked, Novo Nordisk followed up by introducing, in 1989, NovoLet, a pre-filled disposable insulin injection pen with a dosing system that provided users with even greater convenience and ease of use. And in 1999 it brought out the Inovo, an integrated electronic memory and cartridge-based delivery system. Inovo was designed to manage the delivery of insulin through built-in memory and to display the dose, the last dose, and the elapsed time, information that is critical for reducing risk and eliminating worries about missing a dose. Novo Nordisk's Blue Ocean strategy shifted the industry landscape and transformed the company from an insulin producer to a diabetes care company. NovoPen and the later delivery systems swept over the insulin market. Sales of insulin in pre-filled devices or pens now account for the dominant share in Europe and Japan, where patients are advised to take frequent injections of insulin every day. Although Novo Nordisk itself has more than a 60% share in Europe and 80% in Japan, 70% of its total turnover comes from diabetes care, an offering that originated largely in the company's thinking in terms of users rather than influencers. Similarly, consider Bloomberg. In a little more than a decade, Bloomberg became one of the largest and most profitable business information providers in the world. Until Bloomberg's debut in the early 1980s, Reuters and Telerate dominated the online financial information industry, providing news and prices in real time to the brokerage and investment community. The industry focused on purchasers, IT managers, who valued standardized systems which made their lives easier. This made no sense to Bloomberg. Traders and analysts, not IT managers, make or lose millions of dollars for their employers each day. Profit opportunities come from disparities in information. When markets are active, traders and analysts must make rapid decisions. Every second counts. So Bloomberg designed a system specifically to offer traders better value, one with easy-to-use terminals and keyboards labeled with familiar financial terms. The systems also have two flat-panel monitors, so that traders can see all the information they need at once without having to open and close numerous windows. Because traders must analyze information before they act, Bloomberg added a built-in analytic capability that works with the press of a button. Before, traders and analysts had to download data and use a pencil and calculators to perform important financial calculations. Now users can quickly run what-if scenarios to compute returns on alternative investments, and they can perform longitudinal analyses of historical data. By focusing on users, Bloomberg was also able to see the paradox of traders and analysts' personal lives. They have tremendous income but work such long hours that they have little time to spend it. Realizing that markets have slow times during the day when little trading takes place, Bloomberg decided to add information and purchasing services aimed at enhancing traders' personal lives. Traders can use these services to buy items such as flowers, clothing, and jewelry, make travel arrangements, get information about wines, or search through real estate listings. By shifting its focus upstream from purchasers to users, Bloomberg created a value curve that was radically different from anything the industry had seen before. The traders and analysts wielded their power within their firms to force IT managers to purchase Bloomberg terminals. Many industries afford similar opportunities to create blue oceans. By questioning conventional definitions of who can and should be the target buyer, companies can often see fundamentally new ways to unlock value. Consider how Canon copiers created the small desktop copier industry by shifting the target customer of the copier industry from corporate purchasers to users. Or how SAP shifted the customer focus of the business application software industry from the functional user to the corporate purchaser to create its enormously successful real-time integrated software business. What is the chain of buyers in your industry? Which buyer group does your industry typically focus on? If you shifted the buyer group of your industry, how could you unlock new value? Path 4. Look across complementary product and service offerings. Few products and services are used in a vacuum. In most cases, other products and services affect their value. But in most industries, rivals converge within the bounds of their industry's product and service offerings. Take movie theaters. The ease and cost of getting a babysitter and parking the car affect the perceived value of going to the movies. Yet these complementary services are beyond the bounds of the movie theater industry as it has been traditionally defined. Few cinema operators worry about how hard or costly it is for people to get babysitters. But they should, because it affects demand for their business. Imagine a movie theater with a babysitting service. Untapped value is often hidden in complementary products and services. The key is to define the total solution buyers seek when they choose a product or service. A simple way to do so is to think about what happens before, during, and after your product is used. Babysitting and parking the car are needed before people can go to the movies. Operating and application software are used along with computer hardware. In the airline industry, ground transportation is used after the flight, but is clearly part of what the customer needs to travel from one place to another. Consider NABI, a Hungarian bus company. It applied Path 4 to the $1 billion U.S. transit bus industry. The major customers in the industry are public transportation properties, or PTPs, municipally owned transportation companies serving fixed-route public bus transportation in major cities or counties. Under the accepted rules of competition in the industry, companies competed to offer the lowest purchase price. Designs were outdated, delivery times were late, quality was low, and the price of options was prohibitive given the industry's penny-pinching approach. To NABI, however, none of this made sense. Why were bus companies focused only on the initial purchase price of the bus when municipalities kept buses in circulation for 12 years on average? When it framed the market in this way, NABI saw insights that had escaped the entire industry. NABI discovered that the highest cost element to municipalities was not the price of the bus per se, the factor the whole industry competed on, but rather the costs that came after the bus was purchased, the maintenance of running the bus over its 12-year life cycle, repairs after traffic accidents, fuel usage, wear and tear on parts that frequently needed to be replaced due to the bus's heavy weight, preventive body work to stop rusting, and the like. These were the highest cost factors to municipalities. With new demands for clean air being placed on municipalities, the cost for public transport not being environmentally friendly was also beginning to be felt. Yet despite all these costs, which outstripped the initial bus price, the industry had virtually overlooked the complementary activity of maintenance and life cycle costs. This made NABBE realize that the transit bus industry did not have to be a commodity price-driven industry, but that bus companies, focusing on selling buses at the lowest possible price, had made it that way. By looking at the total solution of complementary activities, NABBE created a bus unlike any the industry had seen before. Buses were normally made from steel, which was heavy, corrosive, and hard to repair after accidents because entire panels had to be replaced. NABBE adopted fiberglass in making its buses, a practice that killed five birds with one stone. Fiberglass bodies substantially cut the costs of preventive maintenance by being corrosion-free. It made body repairs faster, cheaper, and easier because fiberglass does not require panel replacements for dents and accidents. Rather, damaged parts are simply cut out and new fiberglass materials are easily soldered. At the same time, its lightweight, 30 to 35% lighter than steel, cut fuel consumption and emissions substantially, making the buses more environmentally friendly. Moreover, its lightweight allowed NABBE to use not only lower-powered engines, but also fewer axles, resulting in lower manufacturing costs and more space inside the bus. In this way, NABBE created a value curve that is radically divergent from the industry's average curve. By building its buses in lightweight fiberglass, NABBE eliminated or significantly reduced costs related to corrosion prevention, maintenance, and fuel consumption. As a result, even though NABBE charged a higher initial purchase price than the average price of the industry, it offered its buses at a much lower life cycle cost to municipalities. With much lighter emissions, the NABBE buses raised the level of environmental friendliness high above the industry standard. Moreover, the higher price NABBE charged allowed it to create factors unprecedented in the industry, such as modern aesthetic design and customer friendliness, including lower floors for easy mounting and more seats for less standing. These boosted demand for transit bus service, generating more revenues for municipalities. NABBE changed the way municipalities saw their revenues and costs involved in transit bus service. NABBE created exceptional value for the buyers, in this case for both municipalities and end users, at a low life cycle cost. Not surprisingly, both municipalities and riders loved the new buses. NABBE has captured 20% of the U.S. market since its inception in 1993, quickly vying for the number one slot in market share, growth, and profitability. NABBE, based in Hungary, created a blue ocean that made the competition irrelevant in the United States, creating a win-win for all. Itself, municipalities, and citizens. It has accumulated more than $1 billion in orders and was named by the Economist Intelligence Unit in October 2002 as one of the 30 most successful companies in the world. Similarly, consider the British tea kettle industry, which, despite its importance to British culture, had flat sales and shrinking profit margins, until Philips Electronics came along with a tea kettle that turned the red ocean blue. By thinking in terms of complementary products and services, Philips saw that the biggest issue the British had in brewing tea was not in the kettle itself, but in the complementary product of water, which had to be boiled in the kettle. The issue was the lime scale found in tap water. The lime scale accumulated in kettles as the water was boiled and later found its way into the freshly brewed tea. The phlegmatic British typically took a teaspoon and went fishing to capture the off-putting lime scale before drinking home-brewed tea. To the kettle industry, the water issue was not its problem. It was the problem of another industry, the public water supply. By thinking in terms of solving the major pain points in customers' total solution, Philips saw the water problem as its opportunity. The result? Philips created a kettle having a mouth filter that effectively captured the lime scale as the water was poured. Lime scale would never again be found swimming in British home-brewed tea. The industry was again kick-started on a strong growth trajectory as people began replacing their old kettles with the new filtered kettles. There are many other examples of companies that have followed this path to create a blue ocean. Borders and Barnes & Noble, or B&N, superstores redefined the scope of the services they offer. They transformed the product they sell from the book itself into the pleasure of reading and intellectual exploration, adding lounges, knowledgeable staff, and coffee bars to create an environment that celebrates reading and learning. In less than 6 years, Borders and B&N emerged as the two largest bookstore chains in the United States, with more than 1,070 superstores between them. Virgin Entertainment's megastores combine CDs, videos, computer games, and stereo and audio equipment to satisfy buyers' complete entertainment needs. Dyson designs its vacuum cleaners to eliminate the cost and annoyance of having to buy and change vacuum cleaner bags. Zeneca's Salic Cancer Centers combine all the cancer treatments their patients might need under one roof, so that they don't have to go from one specialized center to another, making separate appointments for each service they require. What is the context in which your product or service is used? What happens before, during, and after? Can you identify the pain points? How can you eliminate these pain points through a complementary product or service offering? Path 5. Look across functional or emotional appeal to buyers. Competition in an industry tends to converge not only on an accepted notion of the scope of its products and services, but also on one of two possible bases of appeal. Some industries compete principally on price and function, largely on calculations of utility. Their appeal is rational. Other industries compete largely on feelings. Their appeal is emotional. Yet the appeal of most products or services is rarely intrinsically one or the other. Rather, it is usually a result of the way companies have competed in the past, which has unconsciously educated consumers on what to expect. Companies' behavior affects buyers' expectations in a reinforcing cycle. Over time, functionally oriented industries become more functionally oriented. Emotionally oriented industries become more emotionally oriented. No wonder market research rarely reveals new insights into what attracts customers. Industries have trained customers in what to expect. When surveyed, they echo back, more of the same for less. When companies are willing to challenge the functional emotional orientation of their industry, they often find new market space. We have observed two common patterns. Emotionally oriented industries offering many extras that add price without enhancing functionality. Stripping away those extras may create a fundamentally simpler, lower-priced, lower-cost business model that customers would welcome. Conversely, functionally oriented industries can often infuse commodity products with new life by adding a dose of emotion, and in so doing can stimulate new demand. Two well-known examples are Swatch, which transformed the functionally driven budget watch industry into an emotionally driven fashion statement, or The Body Shop, which did the reverse, transforming the emotionally driven industry of cosmetics into a functional, no-nonsense cosmetics house. In addition, consider the experience of QB, Quick Beauty House. QB House created a blue ocean in the Japanese barbershop industry and is rapidly growing throughout Asia. Started in 1996 in Tokyo, QB House has blossomed from one outlet in 1996 to more than 200 shops in 2003. The number of visitors surged from 57,000 in 1996 to 3.5 million annually in 2002. The company is expanding in Singapore and Malaysia and is targeting 1,000 outlets in Asia by 2013. At the heart of QB House's Blue Ocean strategy is a shift in the Asian barbershop industry from an emotional industry to a highly functional one. In Japan, the time it takes to get a man's haircut hovers around 1 hour. Why? A long process of activities is undertaken to make the haircutting experience a ritual. Numerous hot towels are applied, shoulders are rubbed and massaged, customers are served tea and coffee, and the barber follows a ritual in cutting hair, including special hair and skin treatments, such as blow-drying and shaving. The result is that the actual time spent cutting hair is a fraction of the total time. Moreover, these actions create a long queue for other potential customers. The price of this haircutting process is 3,000 to 5,000 yen, $27 to $45. QB House changed all that. It recognized that many people, especially working professionals, do not wish to waste an hour on a haircut. So QB House stripped away the emotional service elements of hot towels, shoulder rubs, and tea and coffee. It also dramatically reduced special hair treatments and focused mainly on basic cuts. QB House then went one step further, eliminating the traditional time-consuming wash-and-dry practice by creating the air wash system, an overhead hose that is pulled down to vacuum every cut-off hair. This new system works much better and faster without getting the customer's head wet. These changes reduced the haircutting time from 1 hour to 10 minutes. Moreover, outside each shop is a traffic light system that indicates when a haircut slot is available. This removes waiting time uncertainty and eliminates the reservation desk. In this way, QB House was able to reduce the price of a haircut to 1,000 yen, $9, versus the industry average of 3,000 to 5,000 yen, $27 to $45, while raising the hourly revenue earned per barber nearly 50%, with lower staff costs and less required retail space per barber. QB House created this no-nonsense haircutting service with improved hygiene. It introduced not only a sanitation facility set up for each chair, but also a one-use policy, where every customer is provided with a new set of towel and comb. Cemex, the world's third-largest cement producer, is another company that created a blue ocean by shifting the orientation of its industry, this time in the reverse direction, from functional to emotional. In Mexico, cement sold in retail bags to the average do-it-yourselfer represents more than 85% of the total cement market. As it stood, however, the market was unattractive. There were far more non-customers than customers. Even though most poor families owned their own land and cement was sold as a relatively inexpensive functional input material, the Mexican population lived in chronic overcrowding. Few families built additions, and those that did took on average 4 to 7 years to build only one additional room. Why? Most of the family's extra money was spent on village festivals, quinceañeras, girls' 15-year birthday parties, baptisms, and weddings. Contributing to these important milestone events was a chance to distinguish oneself in the community, whereas not contributing would be a sign of arrogance and disrespect. As a result, most of Mexico's poor had insufficient and inconsistent savings to purchase building materials, even though having a cement house was the stuff of dreams in Mexico. Cemex conservatively estimated that this market could grow to be worth $500 million to $600 million annually if it could unlock this latent demand. Cemex's answer to this dilemma came in 1998 with its launch of the Patrimonio Hoy program, which shifted the orientation of cement from a functional product to a gift of dreams. When people bought cement, they were on the path to building rooms of love, where laughter and happiness could be shared. What better gift could there be? At the foundation of Patrimonio Hoy was the traditional Mexican system of tandas, a traditional community savings scheme. In a tanda, 10 individuals, for example, contribute 100 pesos per week for 10 weeks. In the first week, lots are drawn to see who wins the 1,000 pesos, $93, in each of the 10 weeks. All participants win the 1,000 pesos one time only, but when they win, they receive a large amount to make a large purchase. In traditional tandas, the winning family would spend the windfall on an important festive or religious event, such as a baptism or marriage. In the Patrimonio Hoy, however, the super tanda is directed toward building room additions with cement. Think of it as a form of wedding registry, except that instead of giving, for example, silverware, Cemex positioned cement as a loving gift. The Patrimonio Hoy Building Materials Club that Cemex set up consisted of a group of roughly 70 people contributing on average 120 pesos each week for 70 weeks. The winner of the super tanda each week, however, did not receive the total sum in pesos, but rather received the equivalent building materials to complete an entire new room. Cemex complemented the winnings with the delivery of the cement to the winner's home, construction classes on how to effectively build rooms, and a technical advisor who maintained a relationship with the participants during their project. Whereas Cemex's competitors sold bags of cement, Cemex was building a dream, with a business model involving innovative financing and construction know-how. Cemex went a step further, throwing small festivities for the town when a room was finished and thereby reinforcing the happiness it brought to people and the Tanda tradition. Since the company launched this new emotional orientation of Cemex cement, coupled with its funding and technical services, demand for cement has soared. Around 20% more families are building additional rooms, and families are planning to build two or three more rooms than originally planned. In a market that competed on price with slow growth, Cemex enjoys 15% monthly growth, selling its cement at higher prices, roughly 3.5 pesos. Cemex has so far tripled cement consumption by the mass of do-it-yourself home builders, from 2,300 pounds consumed every 4 years on average to the same amount being consumed in 15 months. The predictability of the quantities of cement sold through the super tandas also drops Cemex's cost structure via lower inventory costs, smoother production runs, and guaranteed sales that lower costs of capital. Social pressure makes defaults on super tanda payments rare. Overall, Cemex created a blue ocean of emotional cement that achieved differentiation at a low cost. Similarly, with its wildly successful Viagra, Pfizer shifted the focus from medical treatment to lifestyle enhancement. Likewise, consider how Starbucks turned the coffee industry on its head by shifting its focus from commodity coffee sales to the emotional atmosphere in which customers enjoy their coffee. A burst of blue ocean creation is underway in a number of service industries, but in the opposite direction, moving from an emotional to a functional orientation. Relationship businesses, such as insurance, banking, and investing, have relied heavily on the emotional bond between broker and client. They are ripe for change. Direct Line Group, a UK insurance company, for example, has done away with traditional brokers. It reasoned that customers would not need the hand-holding and emotional comfort that brokers traditionally provide if the company did a better job of, for example, paying claims rapidly and eliminating complicated paperwork. So instead of using brokers and regional branch offices, Direct Line uses information technology to improve claims handling, and it passes on some of the cost savings to customers in the form of lower insurance premiums. The Vanguard Group, in index funds, and Charles Schwab, in brokerage services, are doing the same thing in the investment industry, creating a blue ocean by transforming emotionally oriented businesses based on personal relationships into high-performance, low-cost, functional businesses. Does your industry compete on functionality or emotional appeal? If you compete on emotional appeal, what elements can you strip out to make it functional? If you compete on functionality, what elements can be added to make it emotional? Path 6. Look across time. All industries are subject to external trends that affect their businesses over time. Think of the rapid use of the Internet or the global movement toward protecting the environment. Looking at these trends with the right perspective can show you how to create blue ocean opportunities. Most companies adapt incrementally and somewhat passively as events unfold. Whether it's the emergence of new technologies or major regulatory changes, managers tend to focus on projecting the trend itself. That is, they ask in which direction a technology will evolve, how it will be adopted, whether it will become scalable. They pace their own actions to keep up with the developments of the trends they're tracking. But key insights into blue ocean strategy rarely come from projecting the trend itself. Instead, they arise from business insights into how the trend will change value to customers and impact the company's business model. By looking across time, from the value a market delivers today to the value it might deliver tomorrow, managers can actively shape their future and lay claim to a new blue ocean. Looking across time is perhaps more difficult than the previous approaches we've discussed, but it can be made subject to the same disciplined approach. We're not talking about predicting the future, something that is inherently impossible. Rather, we're talking about finding insight in trends that are observable today. Three principles are critical to assessing trends across time. To form the basis of a blue ocean strategy, these trends must be decisive to your business, they must be irreversible, and they must have a clear trajectory. Many trends can be observed at any one time, for example, a discontinuity in technology, the rise of a new lifestyle, or a change in regulatory or social environments, but usually only one or two will have a decisive impact on any particular business. And it may be possible to see a trend or major event without being able to predict its direction. In 1998, for example, the mounting Asian crisis was an important trend certain to have a big impact on financial services. But it was impossible to predict the direction that trend would take, and therefore it would have been a risky enterprise to envision a blue ocean strategy that might result from it. In contrast, the euro has been evolving along a constant trajectory as it has been replacing Europe's multiple currencies. It is a decisive, irreversible, and clearly developing trend in financial services upon which blue oceans can be created as the European Union continues to enlarge. Having identified a trend of this nature, you can then look across time and ask yourself what the market would look like if the trend were taken to its logical conclusion. Working back from that vision of a blue ocean strategy, you can identify what must be changed today to unlock a new blue ocean. For example, Apple observed the flood of illegal music file sharing that began in the late 1990s. Music file sharing programs such as Napster, Kazaa, and LimeWire had created a network of internet-savvy music lovers freely, yet illegally, sharing music across the globe. By 2003, more than 2 billion illegal music files were being traded every month. While the recording industry fought to stop the cannibalization of physical CDs, illegal digital music downloading continued to grow. With the technology out there for anyone to digitally download music free instead of paying $19 for an average CD, the trend toward digital music was clear. This trend was underscored by the fast-growing demand for MP3 players that played mobile digital music, such as Apple's hit iPod. Apple capitalized on this decisive trend with a clear trajectory by launching the iTunes online music store in 2003. In agreement with five major music companies, BMG, EMI Group, Sony, Universal Music Group, and Warner Brothers Records, iTunes offered legal, easy-to-use, and flexible a la carte song downloads. iTunes allowed buyers to freely browse 200,000 songs, listen to 30-second samples, and download an individual song for 99 cents or an entire album for $9.99. By allowing people to buy individual songs and strategically pricing them far more reasonably, iTunes broke a key customer annoyance factor: the need to purchase an entire CD when they wanted only one or two songs on it. iTunes also leapt past free downloading services, providing sound quality as well as intuitive navigating, searching, and browsing functions. To illegally download music, you must first search for the song, album, or artist. If you are looking for a complete album, you must know the names of all the songs and their order. It is rare to find a complete album to download in one location. The sound quality is consistently poor because most people burn CDs at a low bitrate to save space, and most of the tracks available reflect the tastes of 16-year-olds. So, although theoretically there are billions of tracks available, the scope is limited. In contrast, Apple's search and browsing functions are considered the best in the business. Moreover, iTunes music editors include a number of added features usually found in the record shops, including iTunes essentials such as best hair bands or best love songs, staff favorites, celebrity playlists, and billboard charts. And the iTunes sound quality is the highest because iTunes encodes songs in a format called AAC, which offers sound quality superior to MP3s, even those burned at a very high data rate. Customers have been flocking to iTunes, and recording companies and artists are also winning. Under iTunes, they receive 65% of the purchase price of digitally downloaded songs, at last financially benefiting from the digital downloading craze. In addition, Apple further protected recording companies by devising copyright protection that would not inconvenience users, who had grown accustomed to the freedom of digital music in the post-Napster world, but would satisfy the music industry. The iTunes Music Store allows users to burn songs onto iPods and CDs up to 7 times, enough to easily satisfy music lovers, but far too few times to make professional piracy an issue. Today, the iTunes Music Store offers more than 700,000 songs and has sold more than 70 million songs in its first year, with users downloading on average 2.5 million per week. Nielsen Net Ratings estimates that the iTunes Music Store now accounts for 70% of the legal music download market. Apple's iTunes is unlocking a blue ocean in digital music, with the added advantage of increasing the attractiveness of its already hot iPod player. As other online music stores enter the fray, the challenge for Apple will be to keep its sights on the evolving mass market and not to fall into competitive benchmarking or high-end niche marketing. Similarly, Cisco Systems created a new market space by thinking across time trends. It started with a decisive and irreversible trend that had a clear trajectory, the growing demand for high-speed data exchange. Cisco looked at the world as it was and concluded that the world was hampered by slow data rates and incompatible computer networks. Demand was exploding as, among other factors, the number of Internet users doubled roughly every 100 days. So Cisco could clearly see the problem would inevitably worsen. Cisco's routers, switches, and other networking devices were designed to create breakthrough value for customers, offering fast data exchanges in a seamless networking environment. Thus, Cisco's insight is as much about value innovation as it is about technology. Today, more than 80% of all traffic on the Internet goes through Cisco's products, and its gross margins in this new market space have been in the 60% range. Similarly, a host of other companies are creating blue oceans by applying Path 6. Consider how CNN created the first real-time 24-hour global news network based on the rising tide of globalization. Or how HBO's hit show Sex and the City acted on the trend of increasingly urban and successful women who struggled to find love and marry later in life. What trends have a high probability of impacting your industry, are irreversible, and are evolving in a clear trajectory? How will these trends impact your industry? Given this, how can you open up unprecedented customer utility? Conceiving new market space. By thinking across conventional boundaries of competition, you can see how to make convention-altering, strategic moves that reconstruct established market boundaries and create blue oceans. The process of discovering and creating blue oceans is not about predicting or preempting industry trends, nor is it a trial-and-error process of implementing wild new business ideas that happen to come across managers' minds or intuition. Rather, managers are engaged in a structured process of reordering market realities in a fundamentally new way. Through reconstructing existing market elements across industry and market boundaries, they will be able to free themselves from head-to-head competition in the red ocean. We are now ready to move on to building your strategy planning process around these 6 paths. We next look at how you reframe your strategy planning process to focus on the big picture and apply these ideas in formulating your own Blue Ocean strategy. Chapter 4. Focus on the big picture, not the numbers. You now know the paths to creating blue oceans. The next question is, how do you align your strategic planning process to focus on the big picture and apply these ideas in drawing your company's strategy canvas to arrive at a blue ocean strategy? This is no small challenge. Our research reveals that most companies' strategic planning process keeps them wedded to red oceans. The process tends to drive companies to compete within existing market space. Think of a typical strategic plan. It starts with a lengthy description of current industry conditions and the competitive situation. Next is a discussion of how to increase market share, capture new segments, or cut costs, followed by an outline of numerous goals and initiatives. A full budget is almost invariably attached, as are lavish graphs and a surfeit of spreadsheets. The process usually culminates in the preparation of a large document culled from a mishmash of data provided by people from various parts of the organization, who often have conflicting agendas and poor communication. In this process, managers spend the majority of strategic thinking time filling in boxes and running numbers, instead of thinking outside the box and developing a clear picture of how to break from the competition. If you ask companies to present their proposed strategies in no more than a few slides, it is not surprising that few clear or compelling strategies are articulated. It's no wonder that few strategic plans lead to the creation of blue oceans or are translated into action. Executives are paralyzed by the muddle. Few employees deep down in the company even know what the strategy is. And a closer look reveals that most plans don't contain a strategy at all, but rather a smorgasbord of tactics that individually make sense but collectively don't add up to a unified, clear direction that sets a company apart, let alone makes the competition irrelevant. Does this sound like the strategic plans in your company? This brings us to the second principle of Blue Ocean Strategy. Focus on the big picture, not the numbers. This principle is key to mitigating the planning risk of investing lots of effort and lots of time, but delivering only tactical red ocean moves. Here we develop an alternative approach to the existing strategic planning process that is based not on preparing a document, but on drawing a strategy canvas. This approach consistently produces strategies that unlock the creativity of a wide range of people within an organization, open companies' eyes to blue oceans, and are easy to understand and communicate for effective execution. Focusing on the big picture. In our research and consulting work, we have found that drawing a strategy canvas not only visualizes a company's current strategic position in its marketplace, but also helps it chart its future strategy. By building a company's strategic planning process around a strategy canvas, a company and its managers focus their main attention on the big picture, rather than becoming immersed in numbers and jargon and getting caught up in operational details. As previous chapters reveal, drawing a strategy canvas does three things. First, it shows the strategic profile of an industry by depicting very clearly the factors, and the possible future factors, that affect competition among industry players. Second, it shows the strategic profile of current and potential competitors, identifying which factors they invest in strategically. Finally, it shows the company's strategic profile, or value curve, depicting how it invests in the factors of competition and how it might invest in them in the future. As discussed in Chapter 2, the strategic profile with high blue ocean potential has three complementary qualities: focus, divergence, and a compelling tagline. If a company's strategic profile does not clearly reveal these qualities, its strategy will likely be muddled, undifferentiated, and hard to communicate. It is also likely to be costly to execute. Drawing your strategy canvas. Drawing a strategy canvas is never easy. Even identifying the key factors of competition is far from straightforward. As you will see, the final list is usually very different from the first draft. Assessing to what extent your company and its competitors offer the various competitive factors is equally challenging. Most managers have a strong impression of how they and their competitors fare along one or two dimensions within their scope of responsibility, but very few can see the overall dynamics of their industry. The catering manager of an airline, for example, will be highly sensitive to how the airline compares in terms of refreshments. But that focus makes consistent measurement difficult. What seems to be a very big difference to the catering manager may not be important to customers who look at the complete offering. Some managers will define the competitive factors according to internal benefits. For example, a CIO might prize the company's IT infrastructure for its data mining capacity, a feature lost on most customers, who are more concerned with speed and ease of use. Over the past 10 years, we have developed a structured process for drawing and discussing a strategy canvas that pushes a company's strategy toward a blue ocean. A 150-year-old financial services group that we'll call European Financial Services, EFS, is one of the companies that adopted this process to develop a strategy that breaks away from the competition. The resulting EFS strategy yielded a 30% revenue boost in its initial year. The process, which builds on the six paths of creating blue oceans and involves a lot of visual stimulation in order to unlock people's creativity, has four major steps. Step 1. Visual Awakening. A common mistake is to discuss changes in strategy before resolving differences of opinion about the current state of play. Another problem is that executives are often reluctant to accept the need for change. They may have a vested interest in the status quo, or they may feel that time will eventually vindicate their previous choices. Indeed, when we ask executives what prompts them to seek out blue oceans and introduce change, they usually say that it takes a highly determined leader or a serious crisis. Fortunately, we found that asking executives to draw the value curve of their company's strategy brings home the need for change. It serves as a forceful wake-up call for companies to challenge their existing strategies. That was the experience at EFS, which had been struggling for a long time with an ill-defined and poorly communicated strategy. The company was also deeply divided. The top executives of EFS's regional subsidiaries bitterly resented what they saw as the arrogance of the corporate executives, whose philosophy they believed was essentially nuts in the field, brains in the center. That conflict made it all the more difficult for EFS to come to grips with its strategic problems. Yet before the firm could chart a new strategy, it was essential that it reach a common understanding of its current position. EFS began the strategy process by bringing together more than 20 senior managers from subsidiaries in Europe, North America, Asia, and Australia, and splitting them into two teams. One team was responsible for producing a value curve depicting EFS's current strategic profile in its traditional corporate foreign exchange business relative to its competitors. The other team was charged with the same task for EFS's emerging online foreign exchange business. They were given 90 minutes because if EFS had a clear strategy, surely it would emerge quickly. It was a painful experience. Both teams had heated debates about what constituted a competitive factor and what the factors were. Different factors were important, it seemed, in different regions and even for different customer segments. For example, Europeans argued that in its traditional business, EFS had to offer consulting services on risk management, given the perceived risk-averse nature of its customers. Americans, however, dismissed that as largely irrelevant. They stressed the value of speed and ease of use. Many people had pet ideas of which they were the sole champions. One person in the online team argued, for example, that customers would be drawn in by the promise of instant confirmations of their transactions, a service no one else thought necessary. Despite these difficulties, the teams completed their assignments and presented their pictures in a general meeting of all participants. The pictures clearly revealed defects in the company's strategy. EFS's traditional and online value curves both demonstrated a serious lack of focus. The company was investing in diverse and numerous factors in both businesses. What's more, EFS's two curves were very similar to those of competitors. Not surprisingly, neither team could come up with a memorable tagline that was true to the team's value curve. The pictures also highlighted contradictions. The online business, for example, had invested heavily in making the website easy to use. It had even won awards for this, but it became apparent that speed had been overlooked. EFS had one of the slowest websites in the business, and that might explain why such a well-regarded site did a relatively poor job of attracting customers and converting them into sales. The sharpest shocks perhaps came from comparing EFS's strategy with its competitors. The online group realized that its strongest competitor, which we've called Clear Skies, had a focused, original, and easily communicable strategy. One-click Easy FX. Clear Skies, which was growing rapidly, was swimming away from the red ocean. Faced with direct evidence of the company's shortcomings, EFS's executives could not defend what they had shown to be a weak, unoriginal, and poorly communicated strategy. trying to draw the strategy canvases had made a stronger case for change than any argument based on numbers and words could have done. This created a strong desire in top management to seriously rethink the company's current strategy. Step 2. Visual exploration. Getting the wake-up call is only the first step. The next step is to send a team into the field, putting managers face-to-face with what they must make sense of, how people use or don't use their products or services. This step may seem obvious, but we have found that managers often outsource this part of the strategy-making process. They rely on reports that other people, often at one or two removes from the world they report on, have put together. A company should never outsource its eyes. There is simply no substitute for seeing for yourself. Great artists don't paint from other people's descriptions or even from photographs. They like to see the subject for themselves. The same is true for great strategists. Michael Bloomberg, before becoming mayor of New York City, was hailed as a business visionary for his realization that the providers of financial information also needed to provide online analytics to help users make sense of the data. But he would be the first to tell you that the idea should have been obvious to anyone who had ever watched traders using Reuters or Dow Jones Telerate. Before Bloomberg, traders used paper, pencil, and handheld calculators to write down price quotes and figure fair market values before making buy and sell decisions, a practice that cost them time and money as well as built-in errors. Great strategic insights like this are less the product of genius than of getting into the field and challenging the boundaries of competition. In the case of Bloomberg, his insight came by switching the focus of the industry from IT purchasers to users, the traders and analysts. This allowed him to see what was invisible to others. Obviously, the first port of call should be the customers. But you should not stop there. You should also go after non-customers. And when the customer is not the same as the user, you need to extend your observations to the users, as Bloomberg did. You should not only talk to these people, but also watch them in action, identifying the array of complementary products and services that are consumed alongside your own may give you insight into bundling opportunities. For example, parents who go to the movies will engage a babysitter for the night. As the European cinema operator Kinepolis discovered, adding on-site child care services helped fill European cinemas. Finally, you need to look at how customers might find alternative ways of fulfilling the need that your product or service satisfies. For example, driving is an alternative to flying, so you should also examine its distinct advantages and characteristics. EFS sent its managers into the field for 4 weeks to explore the 6 paths to creating blue oceans. In this process, each was to interview and observe 10 people involved in corporate foreign exchange, including lost customers, new customers, and the customers of EFS's competitors and alternatives. The managers also reached outside the industry's traditional boundaries to companies that did not yet use corporate foreign exchange services, but that might in the future, such as internet-based companies with a global reach like Amazon.com. They interviewed the end users of corporate foreign exchange services, the accounting and treasury departments of companies. And finally, they looked at ancillary products and services that their customers used, in particular, treasury management and pricing simulations. The field research overturned many of the conclusions managers had reached in the first step of the strategy creation process. For example, account relationship managers, whom nearly everyone had agreed were a key to success and on whom EFS prided itself, turned out to be the company's Achilles heel. Customers hated wasting time dealing with relationship managers. To buyers, relationship managers were seen as relationship savers because EFS failed to deliver on its promises. To everyone's astonishment, the factor customers valued most was getting speedy confirmation of transactions, which only one manager had previously suggested was important. The EFS managers saw that their customers' accounting department personnel spent a lot of time making phone calls to confirm that payments had been made and to check when they would be received. Customers received numerous calls on the same subject, and the time wasted in handling them was compounded by the necessity of making further calls to the foreign exchange provider, namely EFS or a competitor. EFS's teams were then sent back to the drawing board. This time, though, they had to propose a new strategy. Each team had to draw 6 new value curves using the 6-path framework explained in Chapter 3. Each new value curve had to depict a strategy that would make the company stand out in its market. By demanding 6 pictures from each team, we hoped to push managers to create innovative proposals and break the boundaries of their conventional thinking. For each visual strategy, the teams also had to write a compelling tagline that captured the essence of the strategy and spoke directly to buyers. Suggestions included "Leave it to us," "Make me smarter," and "Transactions in trust." A strong sense of competition developed between the two teams, making the process fun, imbuing it with energy, and driving the teams to develop blue ocean strategies. Step 3. Visual Strategy Fair. After 2 weeks of drawing and redrawing, the teams present